It's a tremendous pleasure to have Celia Brakefield with us here for the first events of this new season. I think when I was introducing Germaine Greer here about a year ago, I was able to tell the story of how, which Celia had told me, though I didn't name her then, of how she read The Female Eunuch and it changed her life. She just walked out of the job she was doing as a secretary at the Daily Mail, which she felt was getting her nowhere, and began on a new life. That life, it's a story that illustrates the power of writing, and that life of Celia's was to lead her to writing. Her first novel, Pearls, which was published in 1986, has sold more than 1.5 million copies worldwide. And she has imparted some of her experience as a writer in a book called Bestseller, Secrets of Successful Writing. I understand why she called it Bestseller, because she is a bestseller, and it's a good way of getting people to buy the book if it's called Bestseller. But actually, it's a book that is of great practical help and use to writers of any kind, it seems to me. I don't think you have to be setting out to be a bestseller in order to find it interesting and valuable. Her most recent novels, and she'll be reading from them this evening, are Sunset and Heart Swap. Heart Swap has just been bought by Tom Cruise as a vehicle for Nicole Kidman. It's the book, as Celia was saying earlier, that Tom bought for Nicole. So that's the most recent public success of hers. She is, in another part of her life and work, the chair of if you can be the chair of an idea, it's...
We call it an initiative.
The chair of an initiative, which is called the National Academy of Writing. And the idea is that it should be a non-academic focus in which people can learn the hard practicalities of being a writer, a vocational training school, if you like, for writers. That's an idea of Celia's, and she's been working very hard at it. I've been privileged to be on the steering committee. Melvin Bragg is the president. And it's moving forward to what we think will be premises and a place which, if we can persuade it to happen not too far from here, we hope to have fruitful collaborations with. Anyway, that's enough of me. Please join me in welcoming Celia Brakefield.
Thank you very much. Can you all hear me? Yes, excellent. I'm sorry to say that it was called Bestseller because my publisher wanted it called Bestseller. I was going for something a lot more pretentious. One of the perils of writing books that can be classified as popular fiction is that you almost never get the title you want. I'm going to talk to you tonight about two books, neither of which got the title I wanted. In one case, I'm quite grateful because I really couldn't think what the hell to call it. In the other, I'm still annoyed about it. And I think my ambition as a writer is narrowing down to getting to the stage where I get enough respect to be able to get the title I first thought of. I'm going to talk to you about two books at the same time, well, not at the same time, one after the other, but together, because really one produced the other, in that the effort of writing one was so enormous that I had to write the other in order to recover from it. So the first novel I'm going to talk to you about is called Sunset. According to my publisher, I wanted it to be called Sunset at Placido's. Placido, like Placido Domingo, but in fact the name of a barman whose bar was famous on the island in the Canaries where this novel is set, because it was the most run-down, spotty, poxy little bar on the whole island. He kept it that way. He spoke no English, no German, and no Scandinavian languages, and the place was always crammed because it was the most wonderful location to watch the sunset, in the opinion of many of the people who went there. the best place in the world to watch the sun go down. And I think the novel was born, really, one evening when I was sitting there waiting for people to turn up, looking round the bar, which was full of mostly people by themselves sitting at tables. And I thought, if I spoke to these people, we would be a family. We would have an affinity, because we have all come here, down a one dead end road to a very unattractive, functional little fishing village, which is virtually defunct, because we know that this is the best place to watch the sunset, and that's what we're here to do. And within the Canary Islands, that's a very rare aspiration, because most people go there because it's got a 12-month summer and gin costs about 75p a litre. And everybody speaks English, German and all the Scandinavian languages. So Sunset was really a book that was born out of its location. And the location dictated everything else about the book. Apart from the beauty of the sunsets, the island that I have written about is the site of probably one of the biggest volcanic eruptions in the planet's history. 36 volcanoes erupted in a very small area over about 7 years towards the end of the 18th century. And the landscape that is left is completely untouched by erosion. There's a bit of moss. There are a few palm trees. When I first went to the island, there were no birds because there was just nowhere for them to roost. It's a completely elemental landscape. It's rock, air, and water, and the presence of fire is never very far away. At least one of the cones is still alive. And the tourist board, somewhat cheekily, has caused a restaurant to be built over it and a grill, so you can get your pollo al diabolo, Jeremy will correct my Spanish, grilled over a live crater. I think I could fairly say of myself I've got a keen sense of irony, and things like that just blew my mind, and you couldn't really not write about them. And from looking at that extraordinary contrast of the crass mass tourism and this apocalyptic landscape, I came to think about the kind of person who would be moved by that landscape and what would go on inside their head. I fictionalised the island, partly because the research was so difficult. The Canaries are tiny little scraps of land off the coast of Africa, and they have been more, until really 20th century mass tourism, nobody took much interest in them. The island has no underground water, it's got no springs and no rivers, and it's got very little rainfall. And one of my favourite moments from its history must be the day that Sir Walter Raleigh pitched up to refuel his boat on the way to America, and must have been met by some distraught and probably rather desperate villagers telling him that there was no water and would he please bugger off to somewhere more fortunate. The eruptions on the island were recorded by a parish priest. This was not Pliny looking at Herculaneum. This was a very, very simple man recording in very, very simple words the most extraordinary events. And his account begins quite baldly with the sentence, "In the middle of the night between 9 and 11, a mountain rose from the breast of the earth." Just like that. I got a translation of what has been published of his account. I couldn't get the original documents. And I decided, because I had a deadline facing me, to make up what I couldn't establish and let the research come later. And the first part of what I'm going to read you is part of that fictionalized account of the volcanic eruptions, with my narrator, and yes, it's a first-person novel. I dared. My sixth novel, I finally succumbed to a first-person narrative. My narrator talking about the volcanologist she works with at the Geographical Institute on the island and what the environment means to them. The town is full of refugees, and their terror is great. I believe both old people and children will die from nothing more than continual fear of the awesome travails of the earth. When the ground shakes, people scream like souls in hell. Many destitute families came to me for help from the parish, and I used a portion of the relief fund to buy food. I intervened in a dispute with fishermen from Fuerteventura, who arrived with water but charged extortionate prices to our desperate people. Don Andres sent six men to stand at my back, and we were successful. I have sent a full report to Father Domingo and asked him for more money, while assuring him that I had the backing of Don Andres in resisting profiteering. A man has been posted to guard every one of the cisterns on this land day and night. I learned from Father Domingo that my reports were to be sent on to the parochial council in Las Palmas, in the hope that they would vote our parish extraordinary relief. Many people have also fled to the capital, and the junta has set up a special committee to deal with the disaster. This committee is also reporting to the regional governor. I announced this publicly, and people became calmer, believing that help would come. Father Domingo assures me that my reports are of great value and has ordered me to remain in Yesto as long as possible so that he can be fully informed. He has sent for an account of the condition of the church lands. Although the disaster was far away from them, he had been told of refugees travelling that way. He gave me an account of the volcanic eruption in Italy, which had buried two villages there and which he said he had visited. Father Domingo ended his letter by observing that the terrible catastrophe of this month, worse than anything seen in Italy, demonstrated the majestic power of our Lord, who has shown us how he can tear the earth like a piece of worn linen and call up new mountains as easily as a child can pile up a heap of dust. 20th of January. We despaired when a pillar of fire rose out of the cracks in the new rock near Santa Catalina, burning with clouds of very dense smoke which spread over the whole island. Now, again, great quantities of ash, sand, and scree are falling everywhere. Bolts of brilliant red and blue lightning shoot through the clouds of smoke, followed by the violent noise of thunder, as if in a great storm. This is utterly terrifying to the inhabitants of this region, because thunderstorms are almost unknown here. Some now believe that demons are gathering to drag them down to hell. The majority of the people of Yesto have decided to leave. The ash and sand have continued to fall for several days. I have seen the good fields, which are the property of the church in the region of Temisa, and they are buried to a depth of three hands in black sand. There is no word in English or Spanish for a volcano groupie, but that is clearly what the cura had become. Even I, the most humble apprentice volcanologist, can sense that in those few days he was baptized by fire and received into the crazed cult of Pluto, god of the underworld. In these easy times, they fly around the world on their obsessive pilgrimage from one live crater to the next. There is a new man in the office, and he is one of them. He wears a silver bracelet engraved, "To see a live volcano is to lose your innocence about the earth." Suzanne says he sleeps in a heat-reflecting hammock, which he designed himself to hang over the lip of a crater. Out here, he has slung it from the pergola shading his balcony. Frankly, these guys are crazy. They're compulsive. They just want to get as close to the hot stuff as they can. They put on space suits, asbestos boots, and anti-thermal visors faced with gold leaf, and they abseil inside cauldrons of molten lava. They pitch tents on the shores of steaming lakes of sulfuric acid. They use scuba gear to fly microlights through clouds of scorching gas. We get the best and the brightest here, the volcano groupies who have scientific rationales for their adventures, rackety vehicles running on academic funds, and lashed together in the name of research and understanding, in which they launched themselves into the fire. So that's the exterior, if you like, of sunset. And I suspect that the difficulty I had in writing it was partly because it's an interior novel. It's about somebody's journey from despair to faith in the face of reason, which is, I guess, where you would go if you had actually sat and watched 36 volcanoes destroy everything you had ever known. And in a minute I'm going to read you the part of the novel which describes the state of mind from which she has to move on. One thing that really intrigued me about writing it was that I made up most of the volcanology, planning to do the research later. And when I did the research later and found wonderful websites called Ask the Volcanologist, to which you could email your questions and get very excellent answers, I discovered that I had made it up so accurately that I needed to actually go back on the manuscript, alter the names of some of the scientists, because I'd got them far too close to reality. And before the tourist board took me to court, tone down some of what I'd imagined. Because, in fact, geographically, this region is not nearly as stable as it appears. Now a little message from our narrator, who is sitting, as I was, in Placido's bar, waiting for the sun to go down, and thinking back over her life, as people tend to do at the beginning of novels. My life has been very corny. Fate saves all the worst clichés for me. The way I met Matthew was so corny, I should have refused to believe it. I would be ashamed of it if things had not turned out so gloriously. Plus, I don't have the same shame threshold as most women. The whole event is like a video stored in the archive of my memory, which I can get out and run any time. While I waited for him, I ran it over for myself. I can run it in slow motion and pause the best moments. Here I am at the bus stop in very heavy rain, stepping back as the bus pulls up and sends a wave of gutter water towards my feet. It's evening in winter, and the lights of the bus glow out into the dark street. If I look carefully, I can see Matthew's jacket just inside the window. I'm not feeling anything much. I didn't use my feelings then. They were hung up in a cupboard waiting for the right occasion. It's the end of the day. I have to go home, and I'm tired. The bus stops, the doors crash open. I fold my umbrella, get on, pay the fare, and take the nearest seat, on the benches that run lengthways along the vehicle. I'm carrying a bag of work, 27 essays by 8-year-olds on how rivers begin. I put the wet umbrella on my left and keep the work on the seat to my right. And then I look up, and my whole life goes off in my face like a bomb. I always pause this moment. In real life, when you pause a video, there's a tendency for the picture to shake, and it's like that with my memory. I can't make out the details. All that's really clear are Matthew's eyes and his eyebrows, with each black hair etched against his skin, and the raindrops on his jacket. He had a day's growth of beard, which made his lips seem bare and ready to kiss. And what is most clear is something invisible, the charge there was between us, the lightning of affinity. Next, I see us thrown back in our seats by the explosion. That really happened. It's not my memory editing in comic strip effects. I recoil, and he recoils, and his foot shoots out and knocks my umbrella over, and he snaps forward and picks it up, and then we get the first line of dialogue. I'm sorry. A Cary Grant moment. Now comes the funny part. Matthew has to think of a way to start a conversation. He looks at the umbrella, which is the most boring piece of haberdashery ever made, and no help at all. He looks at the bag, which is black nylon and closed, so no clues there. He dare not look at me in case the lightning strikes again and knocks him over. He told me afterwards he actually felt the force was that strong and that he would be thrown right across the bus if our eyes connected again. I am looking at the floor myself, knowing what he's struggling with. It's all absolutely clear. We have an instant transference. It's part of our thing. I am also feeling as powerful as Cleopatra, which is a new sensation. And in the end, he just laughs and looks at me with half-closed eyes and says, "Are you getting off at Custom House Walk?" I can't remember exactly how I was getting through life then. I wasn't dreaming of meeting a handsome stranger. I have the impression of a state of existential patience. I know I didn't dream actively. That was something I let go of when my marriage began. When I say I followed a dream in coming to the island, I meant the sort of vision that burns dimly in your mind, the little votive light to the person you know you are, which gutters feebly in the huge dark cathedral of who you have to be to get by. I cherished that flame, but I did not pursue it. And if Matthew had not been on the bus, I would have kept the flame for nothing. It would have died when I died, and nobody would have known it existed. That is now a frightening thought. It makes me feel as if I was standing next to death, as if a truck had come along instead of the bus and hit the person next to me at the bus stop and killed them. It could have been me. So that was Sunset, which was an incredibly exhausting book to write. Not because of the science, which was quite recreational, but because of the emotion in it, which was very strong and very personal for me. So fool that I was, I thought I'd write a comedy and have a really easy time. This was probably because nobody had ever told me the joke about the New York Jewish comedian on his deathbed looking at his wailing relatives and patting his wife's hand and saying, "Don't worry, dying is easy, comedy is hard." I also thought that my next book, which is called Heart Swap, title chosen by my agent in face of the complete exhaustion of his author, I also thought it would be easy because it was, if you like, a ready-made plot. I had borrowed the principle of Mozart's opera Così fan tutti, which is about two young men wound up by a cynical older man who thinks that marriage is the worst thing that can happen to a man, into setting their fiancés a fidelity test in the wonderfully artificial world of opera. It all happens within, I think, 48 hours. They sneak off, disguise themselves as Albanians, and attempt to seduce each other's beloveds with total success. There's an aria at the beginning of the opera. There's no mucking about in opera, usually. You usually get right down to it. So you've hardly been sitting there 5 minutes after the deliciously mischievous overture when the old man gets up and sings this philosophical observation on women's capacity for fidelity. Show me a faithful woman. A faithful woman is like the Arabian phoenix. Everyone has heard of it, but no one's actually seen one. thinking of myself as a faithful woman, indeed faithful to a fault or to idiocy, this always used to annoy me, and I would spend the whole of the first act of the opera sort of seething. And I wasn't the only one. Cosy has a rather checkered performance history in that it was fairly well received when it came out and then disappeared for almost a century and was not widely performed at all, principally because even in those days people thought it was so sexist that it would offend the ladies in the audience. I had always thought that really they had it the wrong way round. And when you listen to women talking about their boyfriends and particularly if you investigate some of the stuff on the net. There's a wonderful portal site called Disgruntled Housewives, which will lead your way to pages and pages and pages of passionate complaints about men filed by women. And I think one of the springs for this book was a fax that was going round my friend's offices. I saw it on a friend of mine's pinboard, which was about 10 jokes about men written by women, which sample what is the difference between a woman and a computer. Answer: a woman will not accept a 3.5-inch floppy. That was the least offensive. I did show my agent the full list, and he hasn't recovered. They were really grossly offensive, these jokes. They were very recognisable, because whenever two or three females are gathered together and one of them has had a hard time, this kind of humour comes out. And it in fact reminded me very much of a section in the female eunuch where Germain had found this ravingly intemperate book written by some 19th century misogynist and quoted it at length, and it was this same completely insane and utterly vicious strain of humour that made me think something is going wrong here. This is not the way it's supposed to be. And there has been a genuine reversal here. Women are definitely talking about men in the way that 100 years ago men talked about women among themselves. So I bought my CD of Così fan tutti, and I put it on the stereo, and I listened to the overture, and I completely freaked out and thought, oh my God, what have I done? I'd proposed this novel, I'd taken an advance for it, and I felt totally unable to write it. And I suppose I wallied around for about 3 months, getting nowhere, essentially struggling with some of the differences between a novel and an opera. In an opera, you want people together, so you could have wonderful duets and trios and fours and fives and even sixes and sevens, and in which everybody can express their feelings in wonderful harmony and counterpoint, and it's all lovely, and you don't want that in a novel. It's a technical nightmare. What you actually want is one person musing gently to themselves. You want a nice interior monologue. And the other thing that I found sad, but very difficult, was that Così contains the most exquisite love songs, the most transcendent expressions of love. And putting them in a modern comic novel that you more or less knew was going to get a disgusting pink cover slapped on it and be sold in Tesco was actually impossible. I could not tell the post-British Bridget Jones reader that it was like that. And I found that the energy of the book went into many other directions. It went into creating a picture of millennial London, which I'm quite proud of, but it wasn't what I intended to do. It went into exploring how all the characters felt about their possessions, because consumption was such a big part of their lives. And it went into exploring New Age morality, such as it is, because I was deeply suspicious. I've been lectured about my inadequacies by so many, so many designer Buddhists that I did have a depth of cynicism that I found was quite useful. And the first part of the first reading I'm going to give you from Heartswap is of one of the two female heroines, towards the end of the process of setting her fiancé this fidelity test, struggling with... she is actually struggling with her conscience, although she has a lot of... she has many different ways of expressing it. Flora was reaching the end of the week in bad shape. She overslept. She had to cut down her morning meditation, and she left the house without getting a proper connection to the source at the beginning of the day. Two client visits were in the diary, both initial consultations, and it always drained her spirit to confront people's cynicism. I should explain that she's a feng shui consultant and environmental aromatherapist. The first client had a sense of scarcity about money, and the second client was locked into an ego thing about the colour of her carpet, all of which created a sensation of tightness around Flora's heart chakra. The stress of having to travel across town in a midday period of high humidity and ionisation created a stuffed-up feeling in her sinuses, which she hadn't noticed since she gave up eating dairy. Three of her fingernails broke, meaning she was low on chromium. Her intuition felt faint, her energy was blocked, and she was sure that her aura was murky. Relief was elusive. Her favourite masseur was chilling on a mountain in Scotland for the weekend. Her reflexologist was booked solid. The acupressure practitioner was on holiday. The flotation tank had sprung a leak. All she could do was make an appointment to see her nutritionist the following week. She drove back across town via the home of a fellow shiatsu student and offered herself for a practice session, but the clumsy cow decided to walk her spine and stumbled over the solar plexus, leaving Flora with a menacing twinge around her left ovary. Shivering with negativity, she went back to her house and put some rose and frankincense in her personal environmental aroma harmonizer. She plugged it in and blew the fuses. A blue flash came out of the socket. There was a smell of scorching, and all the machines in the house turned themselves off. But at least the universe was giving her some signs. Probably the electromagnetic field in the house was causing all the problems. Flora found a lotus incense stick, a tea light, and a match folder with two matches in it. She lit the incense with one and the tea light with the other and sat down to do a flame meditation. Her phone rang. It was in a bag by her desk. Flora allowed her mind to notice the ringing. Her phone was set to announce a call with a little snatch of Bach. She encouraged the sounds to float away like blossom petals falling on a stream. The ringing stopped. Flora welcomed the energy of the flame and directed it to the pain in her back. Also, she had a twinge in one of her ankles. She decided to count her breaths. At the 15th breath, the telephone rang again. Flora allowed her mind to notice the ringing, which it was eager to do. 15. 16. The petal thing wasn't working, so she decided to welcome the energy of the music of the phone. 17. Bach was quite stimulating. 18. Wasn't there something about classical music being the same tempo as alpha brainwaves? 19. Or was it beta brainwaves? No, 20. 21. 23. No, 22. It was only Dylan calling. He really ought to get a grip on his neediness. 25. It was so disruptive to get calls from him at all, like now, for instance. Had she done 30 yet? Her whole meditation was spoiled. Typical. She might as well answer the phone. As soon as she got the phone out of her bag, the ringing stopped. After that, Flora realized that her spiritual condition was quite serious. Emergency therapy was needed to cleanse her mind of its negative thoughts, replace them with positive visualization, and do some affirmations to alter her focus before her whole being was overwhelmed with bad energy. She took the candle to the bedroom where she kept her affirmation book. The text for the day was, "I am surrounded by love." She found love affirmations troubling. They always seemed to be invoking more problems rather than helping her with what she had already. She flicked forward to the next and picked, "I am a whole perfect being. I have everything I need. I am a whole perfect being. I have everything I need," she said, sitting on the bed. "I am a whole..." The telephone rang again. "You have two new messages," it informed her. The first message said, "Hi, Flora, this is Georgie, bit bar at 8, okay, only call me if there's a problem, love ya." The second message said, "This is Felix, any news on our funding application?" The voice was almost angry. It was a tone Flora knew well, and she enjoyed hearing it. It was the sound of a man in need, who hated the way he was so much that he was acting offensively to kid himself that he didn't need anything, or anyone, not at all, not ever. Ha! Flora's spirits soared like a skylark. The blood in her veins felt as gassy as Diet Coke. She was empowered. It was a beautiful evening. Thrilling events were about to cram themselves into the empty space of her weekend. She was an uber babe, and brilliant with it. World domination was going to be a laugh. She swooped into the kitchen and made herself some hibiscus tea. So Flora is the more spiritually inclined of my two heroines. The less spiritually inclined is called Georgie, who is a victim of long hours culture, shall we say. And her task, once she has been manipulated into accepting the bet posed by the cynical older woman who believes that marriage is the worst thing that can happen to a woman, her task is to seduce Dylan, who is Flora's fiancé. And Flora is not really the only character in this book with a bad conscience, because Georgie has a bad conscience about it too. And she decides to embark on this seduction so clumsily that it won't work and she'll be let off the hook. Georgie's plan was simple. She would take Flora's advice. Flora knew a lot more about seducing men than she did, and if Flora said that a straight pass never worked, she would make a straight pass, which would never work. Dylan would turn her down, honour would have been satisfied, the whole horrible thing would be settled, and they could go back to normal life. She put on some high-heeled sandals, freaked out her hair, and set off for the car park. I should explain that she's going to the car park because she introduced herself to Dylan by backing her car into his by mistake. Dylan was there before her. She saw him from a distance, walking respectfully around Flat Eric. Flat Eric is her car. I should have explained that. "It's very stylish," he said with admiration. I should also have explained that she has disguised herself as an Albanian, in this case an Albanian sculptress. "Good car," she agreed, in the husky monosyllables she had rehearsed for Merita Halili. "Very good car," he agreed. "The man I got the new light from said that there was a waiting list for them." "I never wait," she announced. "Oh, okay, well, if you'll just open it up for me, this won't take a minute." "I like a man who is good with his hands," she purred, leaning against a handy pillar. He dropped something and had to look under the car for it. "I used to like making furniture," he told her when he emerged, "but I never get the time now." "People will always need chairs," she said vaguely, wondering why Flora hadn't mentioned this. "That's what my mother used to say, but then she said, you can't possibly make a living out of that." The new tail light took its position happily, and in a few more minutes he was tightening the last screw. "There," he stood up and felt pleased with himself, "as good as new." "You like a drive?" Georgie invited him, opening the driver's door. "Ah," he who hesitated was lost. "Could I really? Would you trust me?" "Well, why not? Just around the block, maybe."
"No, not just around the block," she insisted. "You got to drive fast to enjoy this car."
And she incited him to sprint down the underpass to Westminster, and then over a bridge and around Battersea Park. As they approached Battersea Bridge, she spotted a tea stall and demanded that they stop.
"English tea," she improvised. "I love it. I drink it all the time."
"How long have you lived here?" he asked while they leaned against the balustrade and waited for the scalding beverages to cool.
"What does it matter?" she demanded, panicking because she had not invented a cover story. "I am here now. That is the only thing that is important." "What about your country, your family? Are they still..." "My art is everything," she declaimed. "My life is nothing. I can't talk about my country. It makes me sad. When I am sad, I make my art." "I must go and see it." Dylan felt that he was found that he was feeling good, meaning younger and fresher and less tired than usual. In addition, it was somewhat exciting to be with this woman. The handful of people standing around the tea stall were looking at them benignly. Life seemed to contain possibilities. He could not remember discussing happiness or sadness with anyone before. He realized that he had not thought of insurance policies for gerbils for almost an hour. That's his job. He felt he could do with a second cup of tea and perhaps a fried egg sandwich by way of dinner. Georgie reached towards him, shut her eyes, and grabbed. She opened her eyes and found that she was clutching a chunk of his jacket and the wrist of the hand that held the styrofoam cup. "I think you are very sexy," she announced. "Will you go to bed with me?" "Huh?" "Go to bed with me," she repeated wildly. An extremely foolish laugh broke out somewhere behind Dylan's tie. "Let me put my tea down," he suggested, playing for time. Was she serious? She seemed extremely serious. She looked suddenly deadly earnest. Would she be more insulted if he said no, or if he pretended he thought she was kidding? If he was insulted, would she hit him, or scream, or claim he was attacking her? "Look," he said, instinct telling him to try to be reasonable. "I should have mentioned it before, but we hadn't talked for long. It didn't come up, really. But I'm getting married. I'm engaged."
"You are engaged?"
Oddly, she seemed to like the idea. "Well, yes, very much so, as a matter of fact."
"Very good."
Definitely. She was pleased. She was even smiling, a sort of all-purpose life-affirming smile. Dylan felt violent relief. He was not going to be charged with sexual harassment after all. "Yes, I'm getting married. I am sorry."
"Why sorry?"
Georgie felt violent relief. It was over. He had passed the test. He was okay.
"It is I who should be sorry. I make a mistake."
"Please, look, we can forget it. Shall we do that?"
"Yes, we forget. You go home. I go home. We forget."
She rolled her R's outrageously. Being Albanian was a lot of fun. She was going to miss it. They set off back to the car with one will. "But I will go and see your paintings," Dylan promised in consolation.
"Not paintings," Georgie exclaimed.
"Life following art."
"Art. Works on metal and glass. Very noisy when you fall in them."
"Are people supposed to fall in them?" Dylan inquired, wondering if she would let him drive the car back. She seemed to find the question hilarious. He had to drive because she was laughing so much. He had, she noticed, a very deep laugh. For no reason at all, he thought of hot, dark chocolate.
I know you'll have questions, and we'll want afterwards anyway to talk to Celia. But while you're thinking about your questions, let me just do a commercial break. The Writers at Warwick series is not very expensive to run, but it's not free. We pay the writers something to come, not as much as we'd like to, but something, and we pay the travel expenses. I say we actually go to other bodies to get them to help us with that. And they do help us, not on a huge scale, but enough to enable the series to go on over the year. That's the Arts Council of England and West Midlands Arts, and also some of the richer departments within the university, biology, computer science, physics, and the Warwick Business School. They're all contributors to the series. While we're talking about cash at this first event of the series, if you have a ticket for this event, as you must do, you can go to the bookshop after it and get books at a discount. And some of Celia's books are there. The bookshop shuts at 9, so we'll just have 10 or 15 minutes of questions and then give you a chance to take advantage of that offer. And Celia can stay for a get started. Yeah, please.
Earlier you said
Well, I think it's very tempting to write in the first person when you begin fiction, because it seems so immediate and it kind of lets you off. It seems to let you off a lot of the sort of emotional work of working with the raw material of your life and making a narrative out of it. But particularly since my first books were enormous 600-page multi-protagonist, historically with a historical background, vast tapestries, it would have been impossible to write in the first-person narratives. This book really, because it was an internal journey, it was not... It's not that there aren't events in it, but the emotional events are more important than the physical events. And you needed... Well, I felt I needed a very... I needed to make the narrator likable, plausible, but also... to indicate that she had had, you know, life had dealt her a really rotten hand. She had had a really bad time. And the book really is about her coming to terms with the fact that actually she is not going to have a bad time now. It's okay. And it was very, very hard to do it in third person. It sounded terribly twee when I tried it. And it just really begged to be written in the first person.
In case not everybody heard the question, it's about the process of plotting and whether Sunset was sort of plotted through from the outset or whether some of it evolved as it went on, as it was being written.
There's always a lot of evolution in the process of writing a novel, and you find characters doing things. I mean, I find characters taking a life of their own, becoming people I hadn't intended them to be, and so on. But I always do write an outline, and I always want to know where I'm going before I begin. I think this is basically laziness, which I think is probably down to the fact that my handwriting is laborious, and when I learned to type, I was very ham-fisted at it. And I've always got this memory of it being incredibly difficult to change your mind, because the sheer physical work of writing the whole bloody thing out again was actually daunting. And I'm not kidding, actually. I do seriously think that's why I'm so attached to finding out. I do a lot of thinking about my books before I begin them. And then I write some kind of outline. I mean, I've written 30-page outlines when I was very beginning and very hesitant. I think the outline for this was only about 4 pages, but I still do it because I have writer friends who've thrown away 50,000 words. I couldn't do it.
In Bestseller, you talk about the situation where a writer may find that he or she has come to dislike their central character well into the book, And you say, if this has happened to you as a writer, you've really got to take it seriously, because it will surely be the same for the reader. And so you've really got to go back and sort that out.
Yes.
Has that happened to you?
No, it never has. I've got irritated with characters in my books sometimes, but I've never found that I've actually created somebody I really don't like. And as I have, I hope, progressed in my work, I've also learned that you actually have to like your villains as well. You have to like your antagonists, or at least you have to understand them. Because I think in my first novel, I had a character who I didn't really understand and who was really almost completely unlikable. In fact, she was evil. And I found her enormously difficult to write. And I found it really so hard to do the scenes involving her, because she wasn't alive, really. She was a reaction. And I've always gone for rather more complicated characters ever afterwards.
You always seem to research tremendous amounts in your books, so I have a field of research. I know I'm saying that I'm on this train, but roughly how long would you expect to take on the novel?
Well, it depends. I've written three enormously long novels, with enormously detailed historical background, and they took me about 2 years. The research in Sunset didn't take very long, because it was in fact one document, which was only fragments, and one geological situation, for which, handily, there was the perfect thesis available. So Sunset really took me about 5 months to write. I mean, I think research is a frightful trap, because you can justify it totally. It's enormously exciting. You can spend any amount of time on it, and really all you're doing is putting off writing. I'm sorry?
It's like salt before pencil.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think Lord Archer says he does that. Doesn't he? Sits down and sharpens all his pencils first. I mean, you only need one.
Then he's very, very rich. He can afford all that.
Yes.
What was it about the name of his book that made you want to drop your previous job and go into writing?
Her book explained the situation I was in. I didn't understand... Well, you know, I know this is naive, but you never understand why people don't say, gosh, Celia, you're a fantastic writer. Why don't you have this assignment or that assignment? So I was on a newspaper, I thought I was brilliant, and I couldn't understand why I would be getting assignments like, Celia, it's the cup final this week, and we thought we'd like to have what the footballers' wives are thinking about. And I didn't understand. I mean, before feminism, you didn't understand what sexism was. You just knew that you weren't getting anywhere, and that you'd get sub-editors sending your copy back. The first feature I wrote, I quoted a piece of Latin in it. Which the sub-editor immediately rewrote, wrong. And when I said, why did you do that? I looked it up in the dictionary. And he said, oh, well, I thought you were bound not to get it right. They don't do Latin at girls' schools. And that wasn't, everybody goes, but, I mean, that was normal. That was normal, acceptable conversation. And I suppose what I needed was a context to feel outraged about it. One thing that I think is very brave in The Female Eunuch is that it really explores the power dynamics within sexual relationships. And they, you know, they would be, they are very difficult. I mean, they were very difficult to negotiate between you and your partner, particularly if he hadn't read the same book, which, of course, nobody had. So I found it an empowering text. It made me feel that I understood what was going on and that I had some handle on what to do about it. I understood that really I was in a ghetto, actually. I was on the woman's page of a newspaper, and I was wanting really at that time to write about film, which was my passion. And I knew I wasn't—I was not going to get the job by asking for it and being five times too good for it. I was going to have to be sneakier than that.
I wanted to ask the yes, question.
Okay, you briefly addressed it earlier, but what do you think about the categories of popular and serious novels, and your place in
What I think about the... Well, it's primarily a marketing classification, and it's enormously unfair. One of my great writer friends, and it's jolly difficult to have writer friends, is Mavis Cheek, who... We have written sometimes very similar books with very similar tone and ambition and scope and language. She's a literary novelist published by Faber, and I'm a popular novelist published by Little Brown. And we're treated completely differently in every way. We achieve completely different sales. I get people sitting on my texts and saying things like, you've got a reference to Maupassant here, I think you didn't mean that, did you? And I say, why? And the editor will say, because, you know, a character in a book like yours wouldn't know anything about Maupassant. And I say, excuse me. I have to say, Mavis gets pretty much the same kind of stuff from Faber. possibly rather more tactfully expressed. I have found expectations about popular novels right from the beginning of my career, and they have. Another one that I thought was very interesting was in my first novel. I was published by Chatto and Windus, who were daringly making a foray into popular fiction, and the editor sat there and said, now, the hero here, I mean, he seems indecisive and at times quite weak. And this was an editorial meeting with, you know, the sales director and two or three other women. They said, he seems rather weak, and we think you ought to beef him up a bit. And I said, but I think we should allow men space to be weak and indecisive. And they all went, oh. Because they wanted a down-the-line Mills and Boone dashing hero in riding boots. I mean, it was... So how do I feel about those expectations? Intensely irritated. I do think that the division is really more of a marketing classification than anything real. Because there are, I mean, books like Nick Hornby's and like Louise de Bernier's are... inaccessible language, they're vibrant, dynamic narratives that you can read in the back of a car without losing concentration. They have, you know, they address issues that are of concern to tens of thousands of people. And whether you would want to call them popular or literary fiction really is irrelevant. I feel the same about my own books. I mean, I don't really appreciate people classifying them, although when I fall into the better sales side of the classification, I'm not so upset. I mean, I sometimes ask myself if I'd mind more. Would I mind more about having smaller sales than I mind about being trashed by my editors?
Though I can see that irritation about taxonomy and classification. I was once looking for an edition of Cardinal Newman's book, The Idea of a University. Cardinal Newman, the great 19th century Catholic sage. And I couldn't find it anywhere under education or any of those things in the branch of Dylan's that I went to. I asked at the desk, and they said, well, we've got it. They looked it up in the computer, and they said, oh, it seems to be in New Age books. And I couldn't quite figure out why, but I went and found it. And I realised that on the spine, in very large letters, it said New Man. And so probably somebody had thought, you know, that somehow fitted in there, either there or under, you know, sex and gender or something. There must. I heard that regret in your voice about being in Tesco's in a pink jacket, but there are probably some compensations in that too.
I like being in Tesco, yeah. Because I don't think books should be, you know, banged up in bookshops and kept for. I mean, I despise the idea of writing for 3,000 people in Islington. I'd much rather write for 30,000 people in Tesco. It's the pink jacket I mind.
I don't know, I'd love to be published in a pink jacket. I think.
It cuts your readership in half, because no man will sit on a bus reading a book in a pink jacket.
I've sat on a train reading your book in a pink jacket.
Did you get the interesting conversations?
I think we're going to have to stop there in order to give people time to get not to Tesco's but to the Warwick University bookshop if they want to. And meanwhile, any of you who want to come down and have a chat to Celia, please do. And meanwhile, will you join me in thanking her very much for reading and talking to us.